realm, there are so many different kinds of people and so many different stages of development. Does this matter?
Matter to whom? To the seeker or to the people?
In their development. In other words, there are some people who have reached a certain stage in development, and the ego will perhaps serve a certain function. But there may be others who are much less developed, in which case, is the ego still necessary to function, or is it a general movement in the evolution of the earth that the ego tends to see both?
The role of ego. Ego has certainly a function to play in the development of personality. Ego is nature's device to have a point around which the flow and flux of life can be organized so that there is a point of individuality. Once the point of individuality has formed, once the point of reference has been built up and you are habituated to refer everything to it, that is the point when ego was the helper and ego is the bar. What is it? Ego is a help to many, but when one arrives at the threshold of spiritual life, ego becomes the bar. In the normal day-to-day world life, ego is a help to many. But when one comes to spiritual life, ego becomes a bar. Ego has to be progressively thinned out. It cannot be killed outright. It has to be gradually thinned out so that it just disappears. And after all, the ego is only a deputy. When the deputy goes, is the real soul, the real center of God, the soul that comes forward. You need not preach the removal of ego on those who are still wedded to the ways of ignorance. We have not yet arrived at a stage in the revolution when they are to take a leap into Godward life. Those who aspire for higher life, it is for them that ego has to be condemned. For a politician, for a military commander, for a surgeon who does operations, a certain self-confidence, a certain egoistic self-regard is an instrumentation that nature develops and through which it acts. Even the divine acts through the ego of certain instruments, as long as they can serve only from that level.
Will there be a marked change, a worldwide change, as far as people are concerned, if that the ego begins to go for many people? Will it move more quickly in those who are less developed?
That is true. Today there is a mental recognition all over the world that the ego or self-interest should cease to be the final arbiter of things. Things must be looked at and decided from a larger, a more universal standpoint, not the ego. To that extent, it has been a gain, there has been progress, that there is a recognition of the necessity of relegating the ego backwards. But there is not yet enough sincerity in the people that matter to give up that ego. Each one expects the other to give up his ego. That is the fact, whether outside or inside. As mother said, if we do not learn, if we refuse to learn, nature, super nature, has its way of shocking us into sanity. What she calls the crash of circumstances will force human beings to think differently, to look differently, and to act differently. It's not a question of not knowing, it is a question of wanting to do, question of sincerity. All of us who are gathered here know exactly what is right, what is to be done. Question is whether we are sincere enough to translate into practice what we know. There are 100 extenuating circumstances for each one. Why he is not doing? Understood. But that is the position. We have seen that in any yoga, it is any one power or a number of powers of one's consciousness that is utilized as the means to establish contact, develop relation, to culminate in union with God. We saw last time how in the yoga of knowledge one starts with one's mind, the faculty of thinking, discriminating. In the yoga of works, one starts with will, the will to consecrate, the will to unite one's own will with the divine will and work as its instrument. And in the yoga of devotion, which is our theme during the present series of talks, it is emotions that are the means to approach God. Any human relation that is possible with the divine is taken up, developed and intensified, so that through that relation the human consciousness is cultured and develops into an ultimate identity with its objective in the divine. There are any number of possible relations with God, but in many religions, especially of the Semitic origin, it is the fear of God that dominates, and I would say vitiates the intimate relation that man can have with God. The explanation for this perverse twist to the human approach to God can be explained historically this way. That originally, when the intelligence of man was not developed as it is today, man tended to conceive of a superior being in control of the universe, a superior power which could influence life in the world and his own. He regarded a power or number of powers which could promote his prosperity as well as push him down the road of adversity. And he invented ways and means to propitiate these powers so that they could further his ambitions and desires. And he also found out ways and means, prayers, petitions, supplications, to avert the wrath of God from his destiny. In the Indian approach, this element of fear is largely absent. The root and the basis for fear is the conception of sin. It is regarded in many certain religions that man is originally tainted with sin, and God is conceived as somebody who can be bribed to avert the consequences of the sin for those who know how to propitiate him and who condemns others who are not so fortunate to eternal hell. Of course, in the Indian religions, there is the conception of heaven and hell. But it is regarded not as a product, not as a result of some original sin with which man is born, but as a reward for virtue, as a punishment for vices that man does by his own free will. Whatever the reason, the element of fear of God is one of those hostile intrusions in the cosmic scheme. I remember Mother saying somewhere that fear is totally alien to the divine intention, even as falsehood was not originally foreseen when the movement for manifestation gathered momentum, so too fear is a twist, is a totally unexpected intervention precipitated by the Asura, the Titan, the Antichrist, where there should be only love, there should be only a flow of sweetness. Fear has introduced a shrinking, an aversion, a withdrawal. However, now that it has formed part of the evolving world in ignorance, it has to be faced and it has to be eliminated. This first conception and formation of fear as one of the ruling factors determining our relations with the divine gradually gave place to the conception of God as a ruler of law, righteousness, one who awards the fruits of one's labor, a little bit of improvement on the original conception. And gradually, the ideas of good and evil, virtue and vice, took root. But the idea that punishment is meted out by God has still remained. Everyone knows that God is not there to punish. Man punishes himself enough. Every day in his life, when he errs, when he allows his consciousness to deviate from the right, from the truth, his consciousness goes down. Grooves are formed in his being in which his movements flow helplessly. Is that not enough self-punishment? Man punishes himself out of ignorance, and he can cease to punish himself in the measure in which he comes out of the belt of ignorance. In the Indian religions, instead of fear, it is the lure of heaven and the fear of hell that has come to dominate. Exaggerated stories of scenes in paradise, of the fires of hell, have worked havoc in the natural growth of the human soul in the East. There are even certain traditions which don't believe in God at all. They only believe in the heaven and the hell after this life. If God exists, or if gods there are, they are part of this scheme of the Hades and the paradise. Life came to be looked upon as an opportunity to win entry into one and avoid precipitation into the other. We are speaking of somewhat primitive conditions of the evolution of religion, for it is in religion that the approach of devotion largely took its root. Yoga takes over this contribution of religion, of devotion for God. Exertion of oneself in the ways of devotion and purifies the way from many of these grosser elements. In yoga, particularly in the yoga of love, in the yoga of devotion, one takes up any relation that permits an interchange, an outflow of one's emotion. One conceives of the Divine, the Fatherhood of Love, one who protects, one who saves, one to whom one can trust, and one approaches with the devotion and the love of a child. Closely allied to the conception of the Fatherhood of God is the motherhood of the Divine. The Divine is conceived and experienced and realized as the Mother, the Divine Mother Soul, the Divine Creatrix of all, to whom the child soul approaches for succor, for nourishment, for growth, for acceptance of its love, for taking the warmth of her bosom. And Sri Aurobindo describes that the mother soul wishes it so, wishes that the child approaches it for whatever reason, whether the reason is spiritual, religious, ethical, or what is called mundane. The Divine Mother welcomes the child, takes it as an opportunity to pour out its heart, her heart of love on the child. That is the essence of the relation of the Divine Mother, the motherhood of God, and the childhood of the human soul. The Divine is also looked upon as a helper, as a friend, to whom one looks up, on whom one relies. After all, somewhere the Mother has said, is not the Divine only your best friend? Who does not ask you to be other than what you are and still wishes you to arrive at the utmost fulfillment of which you are capable? The Divine is a friend. There is a certain basis of equality which is foreign to many religions. It is in yoga and in certain Eastern religions based upon love that one approaches God on terms of equality, as a friend, as a comrade. Throws off all inhibitions and has dealings. No doubt, when one deals with the Divine, when one deals with the Divine in embodiment as a friend, there is always the great danger of the human relation of friendship covering it up. That danger is always there in any relation with the Divine, of the vital covering up. But it is specially so when one meets the Divine on the basis of friendship. Doubtless, most of you have read the Gita and have read how the Prince Arjuna, who was the companion of Lord Krishna, the charioteer of the human soul, he moved with him on utmost terms of friendship and equality. And the legend runs that when he was discoursing to him on the battlefield, when Arjuna lost his nerve and conjured up severe visions why he should not fight, and the Lord counseled why he should fight, Krishna asked him, how am I to believe that you are the Lord and you are not Krishna, my friend? May I see your cosmic form? He said, yes. And he said, but you can't see with your physical eye my cosmic form. And he gives him the inner eye, the divine eye, which can stand and see the divine vision that is being revealed to him. Once the eye opens, he stands and sees 1,000 arms, 1,000 headed cosmic person ranging from the heavens, from the skies to the ground, spread everywhere. He sees the millions of soldiers who are standing for the battle, already dead, passing through his mouth, being masticated by his teeth, blood flowing on all sides. He sees all the past rishis and sages and kings and monarchs passing through his mouth. This is the cosmic mouth of manifestation. And he is staggered. He realizes suddenly how he has lightly treated Krishna. He awakes to the enormity of the fault that he has committed. And he is overcome. A hero that he was, he is overcome by the utmost humility. And prays to him. Prays to him. First I will say in his words before translating them in English for you. He says, Namah purashtadata prashtatasya namostute sarvatayava sarva anantavirya mitavikramastvam sarvam samapnoshitatosi sarva sakheti matva prasabham yaduktam he krishna he yadava he sakheti ajānata mahimānau tavedau maya pramādat pranayelnavāpi yaccha vahasārthama satkuto sīvihāra shayyāsana bhojaneshu yeko tavapyachutatvat samakshau takshamayetva mahavaprameyau Pitasya lokasya characharasya tvamasya pujasya gurur gariyan natvatthamasya bhyadika kutanyo lokasyaetya pratima prabhava tasvat pranamya pranidhaya kayau prasadayetvam amishamidyau Piteva putrasya sakheva sakhyo priya priya yarhati deva sodhu. Salutation to thee 1,000 times. Over and again and yet again salutation. In front and behind and from every side. For thou art each. And all that is infinite in might, immeasurable in strength of action, thou pervadest all, everyone. For what I have spoken to thee in rash vehemence, thinking of thee only as my human friend and companion, O Krishna, O Yadava, O comrade, not knowing this thy greatness, in negligent error or in love, and for whatsoever disrespect was shown by me to thee in jest, at play, on the couch and the seat and in the banquet, alone or in thy presence, O faultless one, I pray forgiveness from thee, the immeasurable. Thou art the father of all this world of the moving and unmoving. Thou art one to be worshipped and the most solemn object of veneration. None is equal to thee. How then another greater in all the three worlds? O incomparable in might. Is a classic description of the possibility of human relation veiling when the divine relation is being formed. As the relations are being formed, it expresses itself in various ways. In Indian scriptures, there are 9 different ways in which one's devotion is expressed, one's love for God grows, and they are, first, hearing of the glory of God, constantly listening. Then singing, chanting, chanting is glory. Then remembrance of the Lord, not only during the period when one worships, but even at other times. Then service of God in Himself and God in the world. Adoration, the ritual of adoration, salutation, means much more than the physical bringing of palms together. It means the assembling of all the life energies, the mental and the emotional energies, and focusing them in a gesture of greeting and surrender to the Lord. Then obedience to the will of God, sakhyam, comradeship, just as we spoke just now, and a full, unreserved surrender. These are the 9 progressive steps in which the Indian scriptures envisage the progress of the devotee. If one can have relations with the divine, relations of devotion, if one can approach the divine as one's father, as one's mother, as one's great friend, it is certainly legitimate, Sri Aurobindo points out, that one addresses one's prayer. One puts forward before the Divine one's needs, whether the needs are material, psychological, or so-called spiritual, it matters little. All that matters is that the child's soul needs it, and the need is formulated and transmitted to the Divine. He will sanction. He who has promised that he sanctions and he helps the devotee to keep what is sanctioned. How does the lever of prayer operate? In one of the most beautiful explanations that he has ever given, rational explanation, Sri Aurobindo points out that while it is true that there is a universal or a transcendental will presiding over the creation, concerned with its own large, massive objectives. It is also true that it is not a mechanical, lifeless will. It is a personal will, taking account, at any rate as far as human affairs are concerned, with the human will, the human aspiration, and the human faith. Aspiration, faith, and will from the human end can move the supreme will in its own favor. Of course, it is left to the wisdom of the higher will how it will respond. But the possibility and the certainty is there that it is possible by prayer to move the supreme will in one's favor. How that will act and function itself, fulfill itself, is another matter. It may or may not correspond with what we expect it to do, but the fact remains that our will, our prayer, has a certain effect of pull on the supreme will. In course of number of explanations in Savitri, Sri Aurobindo points out that when one prays sincerely, linking one's soul with the divine through prayer, he says, a magic leverage suddenly is caught that moves the veiled, ineffable, timeless will. And in another place, a prayer, a master act, a king idea can link man's strength to a transcendent force. Not that all prayers are answered. We ourselves do not know what is ultimately good for us. That is why he observes somewhere else, heaven's wiser love rejects the mortal's prayer. Prayer is a powerful means of linking the human consciousness with the divine consciousness. Though we have had hundreds of occasions here where for over 5 decades we had opportunities to contact the divine in human embodiment by means of prayer. Our prayer never had to be transmitted through pen and paper. It was enough that a prayer rose here in the heart for the mother to take cognizance of it wherever she was, in whatever work she was engaged. We have seen her when she was signing documents, answering letters, suddenly halt for a second and then continue. She explained that someone called. It may be a call from Greece, it may be a call from somebody in the ashram, it may be somebody in a hospital bed, but the call would reach her. And she also explained that whether her frontal consciousness took cognizance of it or not, the subliminal, the larger consciousness that had embodied itself in her always took instant recognition, cognition, and responded. Prayer is an essential ingredient of the way of love. We have discuss the fatherhood of God, the motherhood of the divine, the divine as a friend. These are all various gradations. And the highest relation that it is possible for man to forge with God is one of love, utter love. The Gita speaks of four classes of devotees and says all are legitimate approaches. There are those who are distressed and seek for succor. They are welcome. There are those who want their needs to be fulfilled. They are also attended to. There are those who want to know the divine, acquire knowledge of the divine. They are also welcome. There are those who know the divine, and because they know, they love the divine. For ultimately, the crown of knowledge is love. You can't but love when you know the divine for what it is. You know that what you are in your inmost being and what the divine is but one. This secret oneness is the fount of love. Whatever the motivation when you start, as one develops, these elements slowly drop off. There is even a stage when one becomes ashamed of the original motives and one is intent on concealing them. And love grows for its own sake. The lures of paradise, whether on earth or in heaven, they do not last long. One does not seek the divine to get salvation even, but only to love more and still more. There are one or two celebrated verses in Sanskrit spiritual literature which sum up the whole philosophy of the ultimate culmination of life. It is a devotee who speaks to the Lord. He says, I do not bow down to your feet in order to arrive at the knowledge of oneness, nor do I offer my devotion to escape the fires of hell, nor do I want your favor to sport with the damsels or the nymphs of heaven, but I want to adore you, to look, wait upon you in the palace that is my heart, in state and state, in emotion and emotion. He says, Naham vande tava charanayor dvandvam advandvayeto kumbhi pakam gurum apihare narakam napanetu. Ramya Rama Mrudutanulata Nandalena Pirantu Bhave Bhave Rudaya Bhavane Bhavayeho Bhavantu. How does such a man who has no other interests except the love of God lead his existence? What does he do when he has to eke out his livelihood? famous teacher who had realized the divine while living. In a memorable verse, he says, "Myself art thou, my intelligence is thy spouse, my energies, my life energies are thy attendants, my body is thy home. All the enjoyments that I have in life, they are thy worship, and my sleep is my trance, the concentration upon thee. My walk is circumambulation, going round and round. All my words and speech are thy praise. Whatever work I do, whatever action I do, all that, O Lord, is thy adoration. Atma tvau girijamate parijana prana shariro gruho pujate visayopabhogarachana nidra samadhi sthiti sanchara padayo pradakshina vidhe stotrani sarva gira yat yat karma karomi tat tad akhilam shambho tav aradhano. Narad, you have no question?
Trying to break the spell with a question, but there is one now. In the Katha Upanishad, speaking of fear, Yama says in the shloka, for fear of him, and then he lists, yes, the sun hastens in its courses, and death itself hastens in his course.
It is, it belongs to that period in the evolution of human consciousness when one aspect of God was conceived as the ruler who had a law, Varuna, the guardian of law. There was a guardian of law for earth, another guardian of law for water, and so on. So that still, that conception of God as the ordainer, not so much the protector, as the keeper of law and righteousness, was still prominent. Sri Aurobindo has pointed out in his Foundations of Indian Culture how the human consciousness had to go from gradation to gradation, and it was only after the mental heights were exhausted that, and the vital regions were traversed, that the psychic and the deeper levels came front and blossomed in that period of mysticism and religion of love with Krishna, Chaitanya and these day godheads, Radha, where the human soul learned to trust God, to love God and never to fear God. As long as the human evolution had not yet freed itself from the unregenerate animal heritage, this sort of compulsive ethics was maintained.
So it serves for
it serves it. The supreme diplomat, as you know, Sri Aurobindo said in Savitri, can use even our fall for our rise. So the divine uses even the devil for his own purposes. But fear is an intrusion. But the divine has used it to expedite.
Was played in the Bharat Nida.
Oh, I see.
And it just resounds, you know.
Very powerful Upanishad. Sri Aurobindo was very fond of it, Kathopanishad. Very. Yes, quoted night. Verses from there in so many places, in the future poetry, in the foundations, particularly in the earlier writings also. And his explanations of the three necklaces and all that is very original. They give a clue to what otherwise turns out to be a prosaic legend. The speaking of the way of love, what Vivekananda has written in his, he has written on the four lectures on the four yogas, what he has mentioned about the way, devotion is extremely good, because he has summed up all that the Indian tradition has to say on the subject. Where it was, I think, delivered in America, those lectures. They are issued in separate volumes. Yoga of Devotion, I think. Bhakti Yoga, they call it. But even in India, you know, which is the home of yoga and these movements, even such a live, I mean, living tradition of love, it got reduced into a lifeless system later when they started systematizing it. Those who came after Chaitanya, they started classifying and dissecting the various emotions and all this sort of thing, and it turned out to be absolutely dry. That is the bane of systematizing by the intellect. Love is a thing that is to be felt, experienced, realized, not to be analyzed by the mind. The mind can witness, but the mind cannot, the intellect cannot analyze it. The moment intellect enters into love, love ceases to be love. There is always a search for motivation. The psychologist comes in. Isn't it?
Can't the vital also have motivation?
Vital, there is a pure vital, real vital, and a coated or a surface vital. When it is the true vital, what's here in the course, the warrior of the divine, nothing like it. When that vital comes and catches flame, it is on that, on the impulse of that vital, people give up their lives, give up their careers, sacrifice themselves, and do anything for love. It is on the inspiration, on the impulsion of that vital, love derives its full strength for manifestation when the vital participates in it.
But can't the love be expressed in the intellect too? In the mental vital area of the intellect?
It remains largely a theory. World is one. As long as I intellectualize it, as long as I feel the oneness only in my mental horizon, without a corresponding effect in my consciousness elsewhere, it remains a mental theory. There are many philosophers who at some time or other feel that the world is one, but they cannot communicate that truth to you. When it you read it, it doesn't make an impact and change the direction of your life, because it does not carry the assent and the participation of either the heart or the vital.
But still love can come through in the right purified intellect.
Yes, yes. Purified, yes. Because that intellect ceases to be the logical intellect.
Yeah.
Intellect comes into its true role of reflection of the higher knowledge. And when it reflects the true form of love, and the true form of love, true in purified mind, is the perception of an intimate oneness.
But is true love really any identity anymore with the vital than it is with intellect? Isn't it free of both? Or the highest part of both?
Why? These are all intended to be the instruments of manifestation of love. They are intended to be. Once we purify them of their external dross, love sucks them and expresses, throws itself out through them. The love that Christ released, for instance, Jesus Christ released on the earth, it expressed itself at all levels of his being. His mind, his heart, his vitality, even his physical, through healing. It was the power of love that healed. There was no magic or miracle-mongering in it, whatever the interpretation. It was the love that brings out wholeness. Wholeness is healing.
What really is,
yeah,
is love is really no more a friend of vital than it is intellect, though, is it? In the true sense. People, I get the idea that so many people think, use the feeling side, avoid the thinking, when the true being can use either one in its true sense, yeah, in its own higher nature.
Would you repeat the question?
Vital love is not, but neither one is really the love.
I agree. Vital love is different from love, because it is love that is appropriated by the vital that is called vital love.
Right. And same with the other.
Same. But when love expresses itself through the vital, it is different.
Right.
I wanted to share an idea with you all friends, and that is, after 3 or 4 weeks, by which time we shall be completing the yoga of love, we come to the yoga of self-perfection. That's a bit heavy, and I think to take up a chapter every week may be a little strenuous. So if you all agree, we shall have it this way, that 1 week we have yoga of self-perfection, and the next we take the teachings of the mother, theme by theme, not any book. Dreams, experiences, transformation, that way. So that there is a variety, and each will help the other. Think so. After we complete this. Till then we'll take, every week we'll have one chapter. That was the original idea when we started, you remember, the